the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
In January 1173, a Florentine architect by the name of D'Altisalvi was given an important commission. He was commissioned to construct a freestanding bell tower adjacent to the cathedral in the Italian city of Pisa. It was a commission that the architect was really, really eager to get on with. So eager to get on with that it appears he may have just cut a few corners. Things didn't really go to plan. The foundations were dug, such as they were, and the building began. But by the time the stonemasons had completed the work on the second level in 1178, it was clear to everyone that the tower was beginning to sink into the surrounding land. And worse than that, most alarmingly, of course, it was starting to lean. D'Altisalvi, it appeared, has both miscalculated and he'd rushed some of the preliminary work that was necessary to provide adequate foundations for the tower. But he was undaunted. He decided that he would carry on. You see, in fact, whilst the tower stands at some 183 feet, D'Altisalvi decided that only 10 feet of foundations would be needed. And the result was clear for all to see. But he carried on. He refused to quit, and he actually got to level 3 before he decided that probably it was time to stop. The tower remained unfinished for almost 100 years, in fact, until Giovanni di Simone decided that it was safe to carry on the construction of the tower. So rather rashly, what did he do? Well, he added another 4 levels to the tower till it gets to the level that it is now. And the result is, as you've seen it if you've been there, it's a tower that now leans at an alarming 4 degrees. Which basically means if you stand at the top, at the balustrade up at the very top, and you look down, well, actually, the corresponding base of the tower is some 12 feet behind you. You know, maybe D'Altisalvi, in all of his hurry to get the work started, had just missed something. He'd chosen to ignore the fact that the word for Pisa in Italian means marshy. Yeah, this morning we're going to continue our teaching series entitled Follow Me. It's a 5-part series. It's intended to help us right at the start of the year just to focus our attention on what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. Now, if you're here last week, John started the series off as a great introduction. He reminded us that following Jesus requires a 3-fold response. And this is what he told us last week. You know, it's a response of ourselves in totality. It's our mind, it's our will, and it's our emotion. And then we thought about a little more about the way that those 3 distinct but inseparable parts of who we are, our makeup, how we're able to express them in terms of discipleship. And we learned these things, if you remember, learning to learn, learning to love, and learning to live. And then finally, as we progress and we move forward in our lives as followers of Jesus, we need to learn to listen as well, continually and consistently. And then John told us why it was that we were doing these things, and he put up this paragraph, and it's worth repeating, and I make no apologies that we're going to read it again together, and here it is. This year, we want to get back to the roots of what being a disciple really means and dig out some key principles we can embed more firmly into our lives. We want to explore what it means to follow Jesus individually, but also what it means to be his followers together and discover how in our circumstances we can enrich and nourish one another's lives more, encourage and develop one another's experience, and extend that out into the wider circle which we're in contact with, those with whom we have a good relationship, but who aren't fully committed to following Jesus yet. We want to see how we can best develop the relationships we have with those people, friends, colleagues, acquaintances, users of Belmont activities, so that we can maximise the ways in which the love of Christ and the challenge of following him become ever more apparent and attractive to them through our lives. In that way, the church will grow. The values of God's kingdom will become ever more apparent through our lifestyle, and together we will grow more confidently into the love of Christ. So, What lessons can we draw out from the stories about Jesus and his first disciples, all of which we're going to take from Luke's gospel, that are going to help us to grow in the ways that we've just described? Well, this is what we learned last week. We learned something about what caused the first disciples to become his followers. From Luke chapter 5, if you were here, if you recall, it'll be online some point in time if you would like to listen to it again. We read about a group of followers. Those first followers, those fishermen. And what contributed to their decision to do that, to follow Jesus. And this is what we saw. We saw that it was the evidence of a confirming experience, a sense of just overwhelming awe at what they'd witnessed. You remember there was that miracle of the fish, of course. And also the compelling words that Jesus spoke. And it was for each of them the engagement of mind, will, and emotion that led them to drag their boats up onto the shore, to leave them there, and to follow Jesus. Well, this week we're going to move on a little bit further. And we're going to consider the first of the four aspects of discipleship that we've identified, that of learning to learn, since following means learning. And the passage that we've read together is great, isn't it? It provides some really readily accessible visual images. I don't know whether you noticed them in the story. The story's about fig trees and thorn bushes. It's about good and bad building practice. It's about sand. It's about rock. It's about the power of a torrential downpour. And it's the verse that provides the link between those sort of stories, the link into the parable that I'm going to focus on this morning. And it's this verse. This is the verse we're going to look at. As for those who come to me and hear my words and put them into practice, I will show you what they are like. Now here, I think, in simple terms, is a description of a disciple who is a learning disciple. So just three simple things for us to take away from this verse. Three things that are linked to three actions. They are three further things, if you like, that you can add to John's points from last week. We seem to be going in threes, John and I, at the moment, but that's probably not a bad thing. So here they are. An invitation to accept, come to me. An attitude to adopt, hear my words. An example to apply, put them into practice. And I think it's clear from the way that the story and the way that Jesus tells the illustration that these three steps are essential requirements if we're seeking to learn from Jesus as our teacher. So let's just really briefly, let's have a go and just think about these three things one at a time. Here's the first one then. An invitation to accept, come to me. Now, of course, in a sense, that invitation that Jesus gives to his disciples to come and follow me wouldn't have been viewed as particularly unexpected in the context of sort of first century Jewish rabbinic schooling. You see, there was a level of attentiveness that was expected from a pupil in respect of their teacher, of their rabbi. And in some cases, as John reminded us last week, of course, such devotion to detail did sometimes take on unnecessary extremes. In the first chapter of John's Gospel, we read of two disciples of John the Baptist who approach him. And they come with a question, and it's this question. They say, "Rabbi, where are you staying?" Jesus replied, "Come and you will see." And what we read is that they accept Jesus' invitation, they journey with him, and they spend the day with him. And the implication of Jesus' invitation to come is clear, I think. You see, Jesus' primary purpose isn't to instruct his disciples into sort of a prescribed religion. It's not that they're just going to sit down and recite the Torah one to another. But rather, his purpose was to invite them into a personal relationship. And the difference between prescribed religion and personal relationship is huge. And it's a personal relationship that God still requires from us today. And it's our proximity to Jesus that becomes the catalyst for our learning. Now, of course, we aren't like first century disciples. We can't physically just go and accept Jesus' invitation to come and see and to go and spend time with him. We're unable to do that. And yet, I think we can signal our openness to being taught by his Spirit through making ourselves available. So we accept the invitation, I think, to come every time we open our Bibles and read it. We accept the invitation to come every moment that we spend in prayer. We accept the invitation to come every time we meet one with another, when we share our lives one with another, when we are surrounded by those who, just like us, have decided to accept Jesus' invitation to come. And there's a willingness, isn't there, to learn to learn. And it's revealed through our proximity to Jesus by his Spirit and by our proximity one to another. A year or two ago, I was on a sabbatical from the leadership team here, and I signed up to attend an evening course. And one of the things I really loved about it was the fact that much of the subject matter was explored in discussion rather than in lecture format. Now, for a reason that I can't actually recall now, there was one Tuesday evening that I couldn't attend. And I asked if there were any notes available from the session. And what I received in reply, despite the fact that other course members said it was an absolutely great evening, it didn't make a lot of sense to me, to be fair. They really didn't. And the fact that I hadn't been there and not part of the discussion made all the difference. Jesus calls us to accept an invitation to learn, and it's an invitation we can accept, as well as individually, we can accept together. And learning as disciples is often, I think, most valuable when it's done in the company of others. And we can learn individually as we open our Bibles, as we spend time with prayer, but we can learn together. And how do we do it? Well, we do it Sunday by Sunday, don't we? We do it through home groups and through life groups. We hear God speak to us through his word and through one another. We have opportunities to come and to hear and to put into practice, and they're varied, they're wide-ranging. Maybe it's to do with coming to the Christianity course this term, or coming to the marriage course that starts this week. Maybe it's to do with attending Prayer Thursday. Whatever it might be, there's a multiplicity of everyday engagement in this church. But we come together and we learn. And the key, of course, is to make ourselves available to do that, to accept the invitation to come, whether in our own quiet time or corporately as we spend time together. Which leads me on to a second point, an attitude to adopt. Hear my words. I could be on slightly dangerous ground here, especially if my wife just sat there. I think as I'm getting older, my hearing's not quite as sharp as it used to be. I can't work out whether that's because I choose, subconsciously or otherwise, of course, to filter out the things that maybe I don't wish to pay much attention to. Or maybe, of course, my hearing is to some degree or another physically impaired. You see, Jesus, in the illustrations that we read at the start of the passage, warns his disciples that part of learning to learn is knowing which voices to hear and to listen to and which ones to filter out. Did you notice that in verse 45? He says that words become part of the fruit of the overflow of the heart. That's plainly true, isn't it? Because so often the true motivation for our actions is actually betrayed by the language that we use. Now, those verses, the ones in 45, are actually sort of a part of a set, a sort of a series of illustrations that are there further back in the same chapter. And what they are is, of course, Jesus just setting out to warn his disciples not to be led astray, not to be perhaps led astray by the religious leaders of the day, the Pharisees, who spent an awful lot of their time, of course, speaking out against the faults of others without recognizing their own failings. And the lack of good fruit being produced by their lives and their teaching revealed their hearts to be rather different than what they portrayed them to be. There was no spiritual nourishment for the people from those religious leaders. And hence, of course, there was really no true advancement either for them in the people's understanding of God's grace and God's love and God's nature and what he'd done for them. And of course, for them, even when God in the person of Jesus Christ stood right in front of them, they failed to recognize who he was. And so I guess the question I have to ask myself is whether my spiritual hearing is becoming in some way impaired as well as my physical hearing. And whether or not it's just time to ask God through his Spirit to conduct a bit of a hearing test. As we've learned already, I think One of the ways that we need to become effective followers is that we need to make the right decisions. John told us that, didn't he, last week? We need to choose to follow. And hearing, of course, requires listening. And listening is a matter of choice. You know, there are times, maybe, when I choose not to listen. And that's not a physical impairment, of course. That's a choice I've made. At other times, I don't hear or listen because I'm so wrapped up in what I'm doing that I'm so focused on the things that concern me at a particular point in time that almost no amount of sort of shouting is going to actually attract my attention anyway. Again, in John's Gospel, chapter 6, we learn that not all of those who said they wanted to follow Jesus actually did it. And the reason why they didn't continue as Jesus' followers was because of some of the things that he said. They found them unpalatable. They found them to be words that were actually quite uncomfortable. They found them to be words that were challenging of their lifestyle. They were challenging of their preferences. They actually challenged them onto the things that they wanted to do. And Jesus, who watched them leave, who watched them, as Rachel's just reminded us of, just walk away. He turns to the disciples and he asks them a very straight question. You do not want to leave too, do you? Jesus asked the 12. Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom should we go? You have the words of eternal life. We have come to believe and to know that you are the Holy One of God. Which leads us into our final point for this morning. An example to apply. Put them into practice. I think there's several things about life, things that happen in our lives, which we quite instinctively know what to do when they happen. When a fire alarm sounds, we leave the building. When a crossing light goes to green and when we hear the beeps, we cross the road. You know, these things, and many others, of course, become part and parcel of our lives. We hear, we pay attention, that is, we listen, and we follow what we know to be the required action. And Jesus' story of the two builders that we read at the end of the section illustrates something for us. As it did for those who were just sat around him on the hillside. You see, the one thing that it reveals is whether or not someone is truly a follower of Jesus. You remember what it said in the verse that we read? Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? And so in the context of the verses that we read right at the start, it's rather like he's saying, look, you're not a fig tree unless your fruit is figs. You're not a vine unless you produce grapes. You see, the proof of discipleship is seen in whether or not we put into practice the words we hear Jesus speak. It's whether we've been paying attention. It's whether we've chosen to listen. It's seen also, of course, in our eagerness to pursue him. Now, as with all parables, of course, the story that Jesus tells about the two builders is multifaceted. Now, I think it's quite legitimate to view the story as talking about eternal security, since when we place our faith and our trust in Jesus Christ, when we accept that we're powerless to deal with our own failings, when we recognize that Jesus provides rescue and that he provides life through his death on the cross, then when faced, of course, with the ultimate torrent of death that sweeps away our physical life, we can know a lasting security for our spiritual life because of who Jesus is and what he's done for us. But that is by no means the only way to look at that parable. Since I think in the context of the passage, it has very much more to say to us about discipleship, about what it means to follow Jesus. I'm going to play a bit fast and loose with this parable, so I hope you'll excuse me. But I think plain reading could suggest that these houses were built on adjacent building plots. It wasn't that one builder chose a better place to build than the other. It's about the fact that one builder chose to dig deep and laid the foundation for his house on rock. The other builder had exactly the same foundation available to him, just a few levels of soil down, but he chose not to dig down. You know, when Paul and I lived at our previous address in St. Thomas, we decided to build an extension on the side of the house. We had the plans drawn up by the architect. We engaged a builder to carry out the work. He dug down to prepare for the laying of the foundation. And when he got a little bit down, in fact, at the right level, the architect said, he said, "You're not building there, sir." And sure enough, we couldn't. He said we need to dig deeper. To be honest, it would have been cheaper. It would have been less time consuming if I'd ignored what the builder had said and we'd just carried on. You'll be pleased to hear, of course, especially if you happen to have purchased 11 Princes Square, that we didn't do that. We actually didn't do that. We asked him to dig deeper. You know, there's nothing actually in the story either that suggests that the man who dug deep built a grander house. It could well have been that his neighbour built a wonderful modern house, a property that was the envy of everyone who saw it. You see, both builders may have had very different budgets to work with, or very different skills available to them. But the point of the story is revealed when we learn what was left after the flood came and the torrent struck. I'm going to assume it was exactly the same weather event that occurred to these houses that are on the same piece of ground, adjacent to each other. It's the same weather event. Well, in that case, I think both houses had great difficulties. Both were damaged. They must have been. Perhaps the house that the builder who dug deep built suffered some pretty serious damage. Ground floor was flooded, maybe. Maybe the windows were blown in by the wind. Maybe the chimney collapsed, or perhaps tiles were dislodged from the roof, or maybe even part of the roof collapsed. We don't know. The story doesn't tell us. But what it does tell us is that in the case of the other builder, the house collapse and its destruction was complete. I wonder if you ever find yourself distracted by what other people are building. You know, maybe you see someone else's lifestyle and you think, wow, I wish that was me. Maybe you see someone else's home or someone else's possessions, someone's car, whatever it might be, and you think, you know what, I'd love those things. Maybe we see someone's career, we see their popularity, and we wish we had those things. Now, those things, of course, in and of themselves, aren't necessarily wrong, but they can be, if handled badly, hindrances to us following Jesus. But what is true for us as individuals is true, I think, for us as well as a church. We can, too, get misdirected. Our focus can be misplaced. We can perhaps place our program and what we do over and above the people who are here and the people that we are in contact with day by day. We can pursue as a church an ambition that doesn't necessarily represent the kingdom values that we say we value. And none of us, of course, whether individually or corporately, are immune from it. All of us are learners. All of us just need to apply the same simple steps that Jesus talks about here. We need to realize that when we put Jesus' words into practice, when we do that, when we take on the values of the kingdom and live them out in our daily lives, it's then that we can be confident that we are building on a sure foundation. You know, there's plenty more that could be said, but I think that's probably enough for this morning. And anyway, I'm in danger of wandering into John's territory for next Sunday morning, when we're going to think about following means living. But I just leave you with those final words. Jesus says, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? As for those who come to me, hear my words and put them into practice, I will show you what they are like."